Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, sponsored today by the audiobook edition of Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, now available on iTunes and Audible.com, and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and American League Baseball, capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. In the world of comics, Dennis Kitchen can do it all. Cartoonist, editor, publisher, museum consultant. Heck, he even produced a daughter, Alexa, who is rapidly developing into a world-class artist in her own right. Now, I've known Dennis personally since 2002, when he vetted me as the guy who would eventually write the authorized biography, Will Eisner, A Spirited Life. And it gives me great pleasure to bring him on the show today to talk about his two new books. Not one. This guy's got to do two. The rest of us are like struggling to do a single book. He does two. Well, you know, I don't know what to say. Anyway, The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics, co-written with Paul Buell, and Underground Classics, The Transformation of Comics with a C into Comics with an X, co-authored with James Danke. And next year, Dark Horse will bring out a monograph devoted to Mr. Kitchen's own work, at which time we'll have to have him come back and talk about that, too. Dennis, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thank you, Mr. Media.
How you doing?
All right.
All right. Well, Dennis, let's jump right into this. What is the equivalent today of the underground comics movement of the 60s? Is there an equivalent?
Well, there certainly are alternative comics, and there is a whole new generation doing things that are a natural outgrowth of the undergrounds, but I think there's no true equivalence because the undergrounds were an integral part of the anti-establishment, anti-war hippie movement of the late 60s into the 70s, and I think the cultural events of the day influenced underground comics, and they were kind of a backlash against the man in general, whereas today I think a new generation of cartoonists benefit in a way from what came before. Like all of us, the underground cartoonists benefited from the Harvey Kurtzmans of the world who came before. We're all influenced. I think it's a natural chain of evolution in comics. Today's cartoonists obviously have things like graphic novels and bookstore distribution that my generation back then could only have dreamt of.
Hmm. Now, your generation, and I don't say that to make you feel old, I'm just a... but, I mean, your generation, a lot of what went on, there was a whole counterculture and the man and all that kind of stuff, was pushed by Vietnam. This generation's got an equally questionable war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Has there not been the same kind of response?
Well, obviously today you're not seeing the streets filled with the thousands and thousands of protesters on a continual basis, as you saw in the Vietnam era.
Well, not in our country, but in Iraq.
Yes, but I mean, we can only speak about the domestic developments, and in the context of underground comics being a very small part of the culture, it was at the same time driven by that significant counterculture. In other words, back then, I could look on the street, and if I saw a guy with hair past his shoulders, I knew he was a customer. I knew he was a compatriot. He was instantly identifiable. There was the counterculture, and then there were the straights, and there was very little gray in between. Today, you don't see that kind of an overt divisiveness in the culture. I think clearly the Iraq War is very unpopular, but it's not driving people out into the streets. And in part, let's face it, it's because back then we had what was called a draft, and every young man looked in the face the fact that he could be involuntarily swept into the army and become cannon fodder. That's a theoretical dilemma for today's young people. You either volunteer for the army or you don't worry about it.
Was the people like yourself producing underground comics the 60s, the early 70s, was it an angry group? Was it you know, men and women who were just, you know, pissed off beyond belief, and this was their outlet? Or I'm thinking from what I know that it wasn't approached as a business. It wasn't like, oh, hey, here's a great opportunity for us all to make some money.
Absolutely, I guarantee you that was the case. As for myself, I mean, I was swept up in a movement for sure, but I always wanted to be a cartoonist, and this societal upheaval was happening as I was in college. So when I graduated in 1968 and I stepped out of the campus and into reality, reality was there was a war in full bloom and a counterculture in an ascendancy in 1968. And I wanted to be a cartoonist. In another era, I probably would have gotten a job or tried to get a job at institutions that hired cartoonists. Back then, I chose what seemed to be the only obvious course, which was to self-publish without a clue what that meant, and distribute without a clue what that meant, and eventually publish others without a clue what that meant. So I was thrust into a situation, I took advantage of it, but never, I assure you, with the sense of a business plan. In fact, when I became cognizant that I had inadvertently become a businessman, I made fun of it as much as I could. My own letterhead, in fact, in those days was an octopus, and the octopus was wearing a hat with a dollar sign, and each tentacle contained what I jokingly called a division of the company. So basically, I was saying to the world, yes, I'm technically a capitalist here, but I sure don't take it seriously. And the bottom line was never the motivating factor.
My sense, now I didn't know you then. I've only known you the last 6 or 7 years, I guess. My sense, though, looking back at it and the way you've survived and grown and evolved, is that you may have been one of the, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but one of the straighter arrows of the group that came from that time, that you adapted as things changed. I think I know you a bit, that you kept your beliefs, but you adapted to the environment that you found yourself in over the years.
I was a conservative hippie, that's what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. And yes, look, there were hippies and there were hippies. I was not living in a commune. I was a pragmatist, I guess you would say. I was bound together with my generation, not just with anti-war sentiments, but remember that this was a period in which a number of movements were coalescing. You still had the civil rights movement still fighting. You certainly had, at that point, the first serious signs of the gay movement and the feminist movement were simultaneous. Then you had the movement to try to legalize pot. These were the burning issues of the day, and it wasn't just the war. There were at least five or so issues, some of which even divided people in the movement. And at the same time, I think they generally together were rallying cries. And the political division was so deep that you had emerging in every major city and every major campus alternative underground newspapers, typically weekly. Again, something you don't see today. You see what are loosely called alternative weeklies, the Sunday weeklies in major cities. But these were heavily political, often very radical underground newspapers. And they preceded comics. The comic books really came afterwards. In fact, some of the cartoonists in underground comics started in the underground newspapers. But we were a generation that had grown up and loved the comic book medium. And so starting with the first Zap as the notable one and a couple of earlier ones, That separate movement began technically around 1967 and then flourished in the late 60s and early 70s, and hundreds and hundreds of such books were produced and ended up in an alternative distribution system through mainly head shops, ended up in every probably dorm room and crash pad and commune and on and on in the country. They in numbers that would probably stagger some people today who don't realize how many comics could have been sold in such a kind of a rickety distribution system. And I put system in quotes there because, in other words, today periodicals are distributed through people who distribute periodicals. They wouldn't have touched Underground Comics. You have to understand. Oh, and this is also before, this predates the comic book shops that younger readers take for granted. They didn't exist either.
Right. Well, of course, we need, for people who never saw an Underground, either too young or they were too straight at the time. I mean, these were books that had, you know, the sex was wild. There was pot in all the most of the stories. It was, and if it wasn't sex or drugs or a war protest, it was there was some pretty angry stuff going on there. So you couldn't put this on the stand next to Time and Newsweek.
No. Keep in mind, too, for readers who are unfamiliar, sex and drugs, to name the obvious, were not obligatory by any means. Some of the undergrounds were rather tame compared to others. But yes, they broke the rules. They were uncensored, and I think that's the key. So each artist censored or did not censor himself or herself. That was basically the rule. And you know, they vary a great deal. And if you look at all hundreds of them, you can see obvious categories emerge. But what they shared was, let's call it a backlash to the comic code authority that severely censored newsstand comics.
Mm. I'm fortunate, I guess, in the age I was just coming of age, I guess, as a young teen, as these things were being distributed, and I remember seeing them. My favorite was Weird Harold's head shop in Milltown, New Jersey, for those of you who may remember Weird Harold's. And there was a couple places in New Brunswick near where I grew up, and I'd see these books there. And the great thing was you could go into a place like that, well, great or not. I mean, now I'm a parent. I don't think it's such a great thing. But, you know, as a 12- or 13-year-old then, I could get on my bike, pedal down to these places, and buy anything I saw. And, you know, so I'd come home with a stack of these Underground Comics. And I have to admit, I didn't always understand what was going on, but it was such an incredible world that you and Crumb and, you know, Trina Robbins and just all, you know, all kinds of people created. It was just, you know, for a teen, a preteen, it was incredible. I think it was what drugs were doing for a lot of the artists. I wasn't experiencing that, but it just really opened your mind to just stuff that you just had no idea could exist.
And obviously, Weird Harold had no problem selling these to a 12-year-old.
No, Weird Harold did not.
In retrospect, this was the kind of thing that the one thing we feared was that retailers were indiscriminately selling them. So
it's true.
We can laugh now. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, imagine your youngest daughter, Alexa, walking into one of these shops today. I mean, you know, even with your background, I suspect you'd be a little unhappy.
I'd have to go and strangle Weird Harold, you bet.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, your perspective certainly changed when you become a parent. But understand, it was never our intention as artists or speaking as a publisher that these would have been intended to have been read by 12-year-olds.
Well, of course not. You guys were barely thinking that you were ever going to be parents.
Right. But also, I mean, generally speaking, we had disclaimers on the cover that would say adults only, or sometimes tongue-in-cheek we would say things like for intellectual adults only, things like that. So sometimes it was a wink, but clearly we knew the one real vulnerability was the legal side. And again, keep in mind, this was before there was such a thing as a comic book legal defense fund. So we were all on our own and very vulnerable.
Well, let's talk about the book specifically. How did and we're talking for the moment, folks, if you just join us, about Underground Classics, the transformation of comics with a C into comics with an X that Dennis and James Danke co-authored. What prompted this book to be done?
The genesis of it actually goes back quite a few years. Jim Danke's an old friend who was the librarian in charge of the special collections at the Wisconsin State Historical Society. And he there was responsible for what is probably the most, the deepest and most prominent collection of alternative publications in the country across all sorts of topics. And one of the pieces of that collection included Underground Comics, and that's how I got to know him. And he was personally a fan. And he had early on seen or felt that this genre deserved a little more exposure, and he thought that the art side ought to actually be in a museum. And I remember scoffing at the time he first suggested it, that that any self-respecting museum would ever display comic book art in general, not to mention underground comic art. So he would periodically mention it. I'd periodically scoff, even though I thought, yeah, that would be great. I thought it was completely unrealistic. Well, as time goes by, even the disreputable sometimes become respected. And here we have come full circle. And Jim introduced me to the director of, at the time, it was the Elvium Museum in Madison, Wisconsin. It's now called the Chazen because of a big influx of the contributions by a Mr. Chazen. But the director was very sympathetic, and he actually flew out a couple of times, looked at my own collection of underground comic art, and he said, you know what, I think this deserves public exposure. And that was about 4 years ago. And from that point until recently, we put together what ended up a show dealing with other private collectors, notably Eric Sack in Philadelphia, and individual artists or artist estates, and ended up with the show that's currently on display in Madison, and which we hope will travel to other venues. So concurrent with that, we wanted to have the catalog or the book published, and Abrams, which is, I suspect a lot of your listeners know, is probably the leading publisher of art books in this country. So getting them interested was a real coup. And at that point, it was a question of putting it together in a package that not just would reflect the show, but also that would appeal to many, many others who would never get to Madison or the other venues. So in that case, I enlisted my partner, John Lind, and together we looked at this material and put together a package that combined essays. Jim and I contributed, and we got Trina Robbins and Pat Rosencrantz and Jay Lynch and others to talk about the medium itself. And then what John and I wanted to do was to show the art as is, photographed, flaws and all, and to show these representative samples. The main point being that this was a movement of artists. Robert Grum and Art Spiegelman deservedly are pretty well known in the popular culture, but unless you were there and paying close attention at the time or a collector of this specialty field, you wouldn't necessarily know that there were, you know, 100 or so artists involved in this. And so this in part is an effort to put underground comics in the context of the times, to show the kinds of topics artists were talking about, railing against, and also to show the great diversity of styles, because one of the things that distinguish undergrounds from their newsstand counterparts is that the undergrounds absolutely encouraged the individual style, the idiosyncratic personal style to to be out there, as opposed to what is known as a house style. If, for example, you read Spider-Man, yes, a discriminating collector reader knows different artists draw Spider-Man. But generally speaking, there's a house style, and his uniform has to be drawn a certain way, or the cast a certain way. You can't deviate very much from the Marvel style. In Undergrounds, there was no such thing as a house style, and every artist, with few exceptions, did everything himself or herself, including even the lettering. So this book is kind of an introduction for those who aren't familiar with the genre, or if you're a series collector, a chance to see a lot of the art or stories you read to see what they actually look like as an object d'art, as opposed to a publication.
Well, you mentioned Marvel Comics, so you give me an opening here to ask the questions that came from our the live web chat that accompanies all of Mr. Media interviews, and I've actually found a page in the book that makes all this fit together. You did a magazine for Marvel Comics, black and white, called Comics, C-O-M-I-X, Book for Marvel. I think there were, I want to say, two issues and a third that was done but didn't come out. Is that right?
No, actually, Marvel published three, and then there were two on the shelf that Kitchen Sink Press ended up doing. So there were five altogether.
Oh, okay. All right. And Easy Rider in the web chat wants to know, and we'll make the connection to what we're talking about, but when the name Stan Lee is mentioned around you and comics, what's the first thought that goes through your head?
Well, understand in context here that growing up as a teenager, I was a big fan of Marvel Comics. So don't assume that just because somebody's an underground cartoonist, they hate Marvel. I loved what Stan was doing from 1961 on with the Fantastic Four and some of the other characters. I tended to lose interest as I got into college, but they were a certain inspiration for me and others in this movement. When I self-published my first comic, Mom's Homemade Comics number 1, back in 69, I sent copies to a handful of professionals, some of whom I just admired, and one of them was Stan Lee. And to my astonishment, I got a nice letter back from him. I sort of thought he was the kind of person that got so many letters they ended up getting ignored, but he was quite nice, and it ended up being a kind of a, I wouldn't say pen pals, but we exchanged some letters, and before I knew it, he was offering me a job. He wanted me to come to New York, and I was flattered, but I had no interest in moving to New York or to be working for Stan Lee, because I was having fun what I was doing, at least for the first few years. When 1973 came along, the underground comic scene suffered what we call the crash of 73, combination of two factors. Number one, there was a Supreme Court decision that threw the definition of obscenity into local hands, and so suddenly there was a fear of every head shop or every outfit that carried undergrounds that they would be prosecuted based on what was perceived as a local definition of obscenity. And simultaneously, there was a glut of products because, unlike newsstand comics, which are returnable for a retailer, underground comics were sold on a non-returnable basis. So some shops began to just get more in than they could effectively sell, and the weaker titles were clogging up their shelves. So there was a depression in the summer of 1973. And in the middle of that and my despair that I could survive, Stan Lee called and once again offered me a position, and this time I said, let's talk. And it ended up with a compromise where I did not leave Kitchen Sink and I didn't stop doing undergrounds, but I worked part-time for him from Wisconsin putting out this hybrid magazine. And it ended up effectively subsidizing Kitchen Sink for a year or two, allowing it to survive, and it allowed Stan to kind of get a toe in the waters here because he wanted to kind of capitalize on what he saw as an energy going on that he didn't quite understand.
Got it. Well, let's change gears, because incredibly, the timing is amazing that you have two huge coffee table books out at the same time. The second book is, and I'm not saying that one is more important than the other, they're like children, I suspect. This is the Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics, which you wrote and produced with Paul Buell. I remember being with you in your home when I was working on the Eisner book, and you told me that you were going to do a similar book on Kurtzman. And I know this is something that's been very important to you for a long time. How did it finally get done, and are you happy with the product?
Yeah, I'm very happy with it. This has been a labor of love for some time. Harvey's one of those guys that pretty much universally acknowledges a giant in the field with a tremendous influence, certainly on that generation of underground cartoonists we were just talking about, and far beyond. He was a magnetic figure who discovered and attracted the top talent of the day, and his influences were profound, certainly in the comics medium, but even beyond. His sense of humor certainly has established with Mad Comics and Mad Magazine, has influenced everything from the Simpsons to Saturday Night Live to movies like Airplane. I mean, there are all kinds of places where you see his brand of satire have an effect on the broader culture. And he's also a guy who was a great artist in his own right, but never really successful as an artist per se. His greatest success came as an editor or a packager of material. And so part of the intention of this book, and as the title implies, is to show the actual art of Harvey Kurtzman himself, as well as the collaborative work, and to tell the story of his life. This isn't a full-blown biography, but as best we could in the space allotted, we wanted to show how he got into the business, his various accomplishments, his struggles, his famous business decisions that generally went awry. So it's a big story. It took a big book to tell it, and to be honest, I wish I had convinced Abrams to make it a two-volume book. When my partner John Lind and I were assembling this material and trying to shoehorn everything into 256 pages, we were pulling our hair out constantly because so much great stuff ended up on the cutting room floor. And it's frustrating. And when I look at the book, I'm certainly proud of it, and I think it's I have no excuses for it. But I wish, we could have shown even more.
Well, you know, I appreciate what you're saying. Been there, felt that.
I'm sure.
But at the same time, what you've done is created a book here that. There's so many artists young artists who hear the name Kurtzman, and they don't have something to fall back on that can explain to them, you know, what he was about, who he was, why he was important. You know, we get a lot of influences in different industries who, you should read this guy, or you should know this guy's work, or you know, you should study this one. But you've kind of put it all together here. Do you have favorites among Kurtzman's work over the years? Things that, you know, you just, if you were packing for the proverbial desert island, that you would have to take with you?
Well, there's so much. I would say early big influences on me included his Goodman Beaver stories that appeared in Help magazine. Those came at a point when I was a teenager, and they were among the coolest things on newsstands. Certainly the early Mad are absolute classics, and like a lot of kids from my generation, I may have missed the comic books when they first came out. I was a little too young, But those paperbacks that Ballantyne put out that were everywhere, they sold millions and millions of those. That's how I discovered most of the material until I was able to scrounge back issues of the originals. So Mad is certainly a classic in every sense. Hey Look is some of the early work that is less accessible to most people because it appeared as literally fillers in Stan Lee's Marvel Comics back in the 40s. But there's a lot of great gems there, and you see the early genius developing, and you see the style developing. But I think probably my personal favorite is Jungle Book, a solo book he did in 1959 that you could argue was the first graphic novel. It basically, he did exactly what Will Eisner did in terms of four original short stories published as an original paperback. It paralleled Contract with God to a surprising degree, yet it came out 25 years sooner. The difference is Will Eisner's was successful, and it recognized the industry, and Harvey's was a commercial dud and quickly forgotten, except for a few aficionados.
So you're not looking to reopen the argument about what was the first graphic novel, are you?
You can argue it endlessly, and there certainly there are things that preceded Harvey that, like, for instance, rhymes with Lust, I think it was one that came out around 1950 and was even more of a commercial dud. and you know, you can split hairs on what's first and how you define it, the same as scholars still arguing whether the Yellow Kid was first or the Europeans who have their own claims. And those arguments are probably best left to academicians. But certainly what you can't deny is that Harvey Kurtzman was an amazing innovator. Even as early as 1954, he attempted to do an adaptation of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Story. He called it Marley's Ghost, and he produced 8 or 10 pages that are marvelous, but he tried to sell them to people like Simon and Schuster in the early 50s when... I mean, to say they didn't get it would be an understatement. He basically was mining a field that only something like Classics Illustrated was able to do as a dime comic with no respect. To do it in an artistic manner, as he attempted, and with Dickens' own words, was something that serious publishers, just couldn't even fathom. So he was way, way ahead of his time. And imagine this was done the same time, incidentally, that he was in the middle of creating Mad, which was an enormous accomplishment and time drain of its own. So he was tireless in that sense and constantly experimenting, and he just had an unbridled imagination and an infamous eye for detail and an insistence on research that in the pre-Google age is all the more astonishing, because he had to literally spend hours and hours at the New York Public Library finding facts and data and references that today you could find online in minutes.
Now, Dennis, Harvey worked with some of the best-known publishers of the last 50 years, in Hugh Hefner and Bill Gaines. Why didn't it work out with Mad? Why did Hefner snuff out the magazine that he was doing with Harvey?
Sure. Now it's a complicated story. To try to reduce it to the essence, you have to keep in mind that Harvey was hired by Bill Gaines when he was in a rather desperate situation. At the end of the 40s, he had basically lost his gig with Stan Lee, and he was a new father, and he was desperately trying to, you know, earn enough to keep his family alive, and that's difficult when you're a freelancer. Bill Gaines gave him steady work, and that was something he deeply appreciated, and Bill Gaines gave him the freedom to soon developed the series Two-Fisted Tales and Frontline Combat, which he edited and drew many of the stories himself and wrote and laid out the stories for others. And those in themselves are magnificent books to look back on, but at the time he could not make a living doing those because of what I was just talking about, the tremendous research time. He was paid, remember, by the page. He was not an employee who got a weekly check. He was paid per page. So if he had to spend a day at the library just in order to get the facts to write a script, he already lost effectively a day's pay. He didn't get paid for that research time. So he was finding that he just couldn't earn enough. And so in talking to Gaines about how to rectify that, they came up with the idea of maybe a humor comic book that wouldn't require research time. And so he came up with the concept of MAD, and Bill Gaines gave him complete freedom. And for that, he was very appreciative. But again, he was paid a flat rate per book, a munificent $500 in retrospect for every issue of MAD. And it very quickly had a tremendous impact. It was unlike anything else on the newsstands. And among the fans who were discovering it was Hugh Hefner, who at the time was himself just emerging with Playboy almost simultaneous with the emergence of MAD. He was based in Chicago, and he would pick them up off the newsstands. And he basically, in New York, arranged to meet Kurtzman and basically said, look, I think what you're doing is amazing. And Kurtzman, in turn, was impressed with Hefner because he was a pioneer of the sexual revolution, and Harvey was one of those young post-war guys who was caught up in that general philosophy of sexual liberation and thought that Hefner was the, you know, coolest guy in the Western Hemisphere. So there was a mutual admiration society going on there. So in that context, keep in mind that Bill Gaines, for all his virtues, was also a very paternalistic, kind of old-fashioned guy with not the kind of vision or imagination that Harvey thought was compatible with his own vision. And so he fought with Gaines a lot over things like format and pay and respect. And at the end of the day, and this is after, keep in mind, he convinced, this is Bill Gaines, for larger context, there's so much to compress here, but the Kefauver hearings and such, Wortham groups around the country had basically shut down the free-for-all comic book industry in which horror comics and comics that were deemed as harmful to kids, those were being eradicated. And Bill Gaines' entire EC line, as a result, went down the drain. And the only thing he could salvage was MAD, because Harvey convinced him that if MAD became a newsstand magazine, it would not be lost. And Bill and Harvey convinced Bill's mother, who really was the wallet here, to invest a great deal of money in changing the format. And MAD magazine, starting with number 28, was itself a huge success, and it saved Gaines' company. In the context of this, Harvey was still unhappy, because MAD, though it was slicker than a comic book, and Harvey always wanted slick, he also wanted color, and he wanted things that he just couldn't convince Bill to do. And on the sidelines, Hugh Hefner basically kept whispering in Harvey's ear, and he kept saying things like, look, if you want to leave that two-bit operation, come and work for me. I'll give you color. I'll give you everything you want. And at one point, Hefner said, look, if I were you, I'd walk into Gaines's office, and I'd say, look, if you don't give me 51% of this publication and give me control, I'd just walk. And he gave Harvey the courage to do that, because Harvey knew the backup plan was Hefner. And so he didn't himself walk into Gaines' office, but his surrogate, Harry Chester, did. And when Harry Chester demanded 51% on Harvey's behalf, Gaines was flabbergasted, to say the least. And in subsequent interviews, he confessed that he would have given Harvey at least 10% of equity, and at other times he said he'd have given him as much as 49% of MAD. But on principle, he would not give him 51, which is understandable.
Sure.
Harvey would not compromise, because really, in retrospect, Harvey didn't want to work for Bill. He didn't think Bill was a very cool guy. That sums it up. And Hefner was Mr. Cool. And Hefner promised him a color slick magazine affiliated and promoted via Playboy, which was the coolest magazine on the planet at that point. And so to him, it was a no-brainer. So he walked away from equity in a going concern, went to work for Hefner. And his timing, as always, was the worst, because in 1957, which is when he made the switch, Hefner had one of the few setbacks in his career financially. And after just two issues of Trump, Hefner had to pull the plug, and it broke Harvey's heart. But by then it was too late to go back. 5 years later, Bill Gaines sold MAD for a reported $5 million. So Harvey could have had anywhere from $500,000 to $2.5 million in that sale, money of the likes of which he never in his life saw. And traded that for two issues of a beautiful magazine that hardly anybody's ever heard of.
Let's, in the time we have, tell me about, well, two things I want to ask you about Harvey. Tell me about Harvey's business sense. I remember doing the Eisner book and talking to Adele Kurtzman, and I think she was the one who said that, you know, he was a guy who believed in a handshake deal. You know, if someone shook hands with you and said they were going to do something, he believed they'd do it, even though time after time they didn't.
It's true. It's absolutely true. In fact, as Adele famously said, with relation to Will Eisner, who was an exceptional businessman for an artist, she said, Harvey always went to Will Eisner for advice, but he never took it.
Right.
Will was the kind of guy who, of course, got everything in writing. Harvey, as you say, thought the handshake was adequate. And a perfect example is when he went back to Hefner several years after Trump folded, he went back and did Little Annie Fanny. He thought he owned Little Annie Fanny. And in fact, Hugh Hefner owned Little Annie Fanny. And it took literally years for Harvey to realize, when he started noticing the copyright lines weren't in his name, and it was too late. And at that point, he was in a financial trap, and he had no viable way to challenge what in his mind was a clear handshake agreement. And again, we won't digress here on whether Hefner was a complete villain or whether Harvey was naive, but suffice to say, Will Eisner would have handled it very differently.
And Dennis Kitchen, after being affiliated with Will Eisner, would have handled it differently.
Yes, I learned a lot from both, but I certainly learned from Will to get things in writing.
Yeah.
But
Well, and the last thing, because I don't want to go too much over the time we promised to keep to here. You had the opportunity to spend time and get to know Harvey over the years. You spent time with him. Tell us just before we go about the man himself. What was Harvey Kurtzman, the person, like?
Well, you know, he was very generous with his time. He was a classic case of a guy who was constantly busy and always behind the eight ball with deadlines. But take me in his example. When I was a nobody and I contacted him, he wrote letters and he was encouraging. And when I got to know him later, I realized just how generous that was, because he was a very busy guy who was scrambling to make a living. He was obviously, his reputation is he was a tyrant as an editor, but you couldn't meet a sweeter guy as a human being. The tyranny of his editing came from an absolute confidence that his way of telling a story or his way of composing a panel was the absolute best way. And he was so adamant that he had to insist on it, even when it meant offending his collaborators' own sense of what was the best solution to that story or that panel. His techniques might be viewed as a little harsh by some, but I never saw him on a personal level be remotely tyrannical. He was a real marshmallow outside of those editing aspects of his career. I also saw a guy who was very humble, who, despite all of his accomplishments, had a lot of self-doubts and didn't quite necessarily understand what all the commotion was about, particularly when it came to his own artwork, which he felt was completely non-commercial. Technically, he was right, but he's what I call an artist's artist, and I don't know an artist who doesn't think Harvey himself was an amazing artist. But whenever I or someone would tell them that, his standard line was, yeah, you and my mother. I think he's a guy who probably suffered from having too many talents in a way, and he was never able to just focus on being an artist. If I was in charge, I would have had Harvey do more things like Jungle Book that he wrote and drew himself, that I think are just magnificent pieces of satire. But it wasn't in the cards, and so only a small part of his output was a material that he had complete control over. And for the most part, especially the last 25 years of his life when he was doing the formulaic Little Annie Fanny, he didn't really have control over it, and it's a shame.
Mm. I'm reminded of another story in that mode that you actually gave me a copy of that he did, The Grasshopper and the Ant, which I think Kitchen Sink published. It's a phenomenal story. Just really enjoyed that.
By the way, is reprinted in full in the new book as well.
That's what made me think of it. I was just looking at it. I know I promised to let you go, but I got to ask you about your daughter, Alexa Kitchen. You guys self-published a book by her a couple of years ago, and I understand her second book is coming out from a major publisher in August. What's going on with that?
Yes, actually, Hyperion, which is a division of Disney, is publishing a book called Grown-Ups Are Dumb, and in parentheses, No Offense, which is a collection of some of her work from the past couple of years when she was 9 and 10 years old. There's a short video on YouTube if any listeners are curious to get a snippet of it. It'll be out in August. She's a reluctant author. She has no interest in promoting it or going to shows or doing signings. She just likes to draw on her own. But certainly a bit of a novelty because of her age. Her first work was published when she was 7 years old, and astonishingly it was nominated for both a Harvey Award and an Eisner Award. And, of course, she was oblivious. And to this day, it rolls her eyes when anybody mentions that stuff because she's still just a kid. She likes to draw. And so we're just trying to, as quietly as possible, get some of the work out there without embarrassing her too much.
That's hard. You're a parent. Anything you do will embarrass.
Exactly.
Well, listen, folks, you can find Dennis Kitchen's two new books, The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics, which is co-written with Paul Buell, and Underground Classics, The Transformation of Comics into Comics, with an X, co-authored with James Danke, in great bookstores everywhere, or online at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com, Amazon.com. And Dennis has a lot of sites. I was going to give out Dennis, that's Dennis with one N, by the way, DENISKitchen.com. Dennis, is there any other site you want to point people to if they want to know more?
Well, there certainly are links from that one that'll take you to others. There wouldn't be an easy way to plug that right now, but thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I'm delighted for your latest successes. I look forward to the Dennis Kitchen monograph coming out next year, I guess, from Dark Horse.
Right.
And hope you'll come back and talk to us about that. And you know, best wishes to Stacy and Alexa and the rest of your crew.
Thanks very much, Bob.
All right, thanks for joining us on Mr. Media.
It's been fun.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And folks, for more interviews with your favorite comic artists and writers, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Dave Gibbons, Monty Wolverton, Trina Robbins, Gene Colan, Mike Gold, Wendy Peeney, Joe Sinnott, Chuck Dixon, Peter Cooper, Drew Friedman, Daniel Pink, and many more. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, True Slant, Pointer Online, MySpace, Facebook, Bebo, NetVibes, Multiply, Zanga, Friendster, FriendFeed, Orkut, Bebo, Podcast Pickle, Vox, Folio, MediaFly, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, PageFlakes, Eons, Mi Gente, Zimbio, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media in iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews within the podcast section of iTunes and click the free subscribe button. It's that easy. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate it when you give up a piece of your day and spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.